Good evening. I'm James Wright. I'm the temporary chair of the Budget and Finance Committee of the Writers Advisory Council. And I would like to welcome Mr. Bill Green of Metro's Budget Office. And the purpose of his visit is to educate RAC members and members of the audience on how the budget process works. A lot of people think that what happens is that the board of directors decides, okay, we need a budget, so this is what we're going to do, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Mr. Green is going to tell us otherwise. He's going to give us details as to how it happens, and perhaps, and he won't say this, but how we can influence the process to benefit writers. Mr. Green?
Whoops, that might help. So I've been here at Metro for about a year and a half. I came from Washington State. There I was, I worked for 18 years with Washington State Ferries, the largest ferry system in North America. They have a very, very active Writers Advisory Council, each of the communities, and they all have different kind of needs. Some of them are very remote, some of them are very rural, some of them are very suburban with large commuter traffic. And so I'm very familiar with the role of Writer Advisory Councils, and I very much respect what you do, and I'm very much a big supporter. So let me just say up front, if there's any of this material, you can stop me at any time. Also, maybe in the future, if there's particular parts of the materials that you'd like more information on, we'd be happy to come back. All right, so I'll just kind of run you through. There's a lot to cover, a lot of slides. I'll go through some of them, but maybe you can take this material, look at it, and then also feel free to email me, and I can give you links. There's a lot of good budget material out on our website. Next slide, please. Okay, so of course, established in 1967. I think you're pretty much familiar with this, even more than I. Some of the stats here, the ridership. I think the important thing here is that for FY13, we had kind of predicted pretty much flat ridership over FY12, you know, as a result of the ridership increase, or excuse me, the fare increase and so forth. It was tamping down some of the growth. And then also, as we've gone through FY13, the combination of the federal transit benefit, the repeal of the federal transit benefit, and subsequently it was restored, but that had an impact on ridership also. So that's kind of just some information for you, background information. Go ahead. Of course, the regional benefits of Metro, just like all big metropolitan areas, transit is so important to the region, both economically and just to move the folks around, recreational activities, that kind of thing. So you can see here a few more stats. Some of them are pretty impressive. 17% of the region's commuting trips versus 5% nationally. That's quite impressive. Removing more than 500,000 vehicles per day off the busy roads. Sure.
Are you coming up with that statistic by comparison only where there are transit systems? Or is that nationwide, including Iowa?
I would imagine that's a good question, but I'm going to tell you it's a regional benefit transit study, so I'm assuming that it's in areas that have transit systems. You can see not only does transit get people to where they're going at, you know, a fraction of the cost of driving and owning a vehicle, and a lot of people think that, you know, transit's heavily subsidized, but really what's lost in a lot of the calculations is the real subsidies for highways and cars. It's staggering. The numbers are quite staggering. So transit, we estimate about 41 million gallons of fuel a year is saved. And not only saved, and not only is that money saved, but those tons of emissions are also reduced from the area. So, it's got multiple benefits, transit. And I don't have to tell this group that. Of course, our biggest riders is the federal government. 50% of the stations are located at federal facilities, and during the peak, about 40% of our riders are federal employees. And so, again, getting back to that issue we had with the federal transit benefit, that hit us particularly hard. Generates development revenue or development value for jurisdictions. Those communities within a half a mile of metro stations gain huge money from development and taxes and so forth. What's not on that sheet is taxes that are generated for the region. So as we look to the future, metro is going to be critical. We'll get into that in a little bit with our new strategic plan, but we're projecting 40% job growth and about 30% population growth by 2040. Next slide, please. Just some information about metro, the size of metro. Almost 13,000 employees, almost 1,500 buses. You can read the list as well as I. 86 rail stations, soon to be 91 with the introduction of the Silver Line. Go ahead. Okay, so this, in past and in a lot of positions I've had, budget is a very financial exercise. How much money do you need for labor? How much do you need for benefits? And you go down the list. That's the traditional way to develop budgets. Here at Metro, the board has adopted a strategic plan. And what we tried to do this year was to discuss the budget and develop the budget more in the context of what does the rider get, and use the framework of the strategic plan to actually build the budget. So let me kind of show you how we did that. So these are the four strategic goals that the board has adopted. Premier safety culture. You know, the customers and employees deserve a safe environment on the job, in the buses, trains, shelters. A metro ride is a safe ride. Meet or exceed customer expectations. You should be able to, it should be consistent, it should be convenient, and it should be reliable. It should be comfortable, clean, safe, and our information should be easy to hear, and you should have an easy time getting that information to plan your trip and to take that trip. Improve regional connection and regional mobility and connect communities. We work with 15 agencies right now to provide transit in the region, and we look forward to ensuring all the communities have access to transit and that crosses and connects the region. Actually, Metro, when you think about it, that's almost at the core of what we do. Sometimes we think of connecting communities as the new things, but really that's what we do with the base things that we do. Ensure fiscal stability, invest in our people and assets. Our people are one of our most valuable assets, so we're certainly focused on that. So let me show you how we broke this down. The next thing, next slide. So rather than the traditional go to your base budget, and then I don't know if those of you are familiar with governmental budgeting, but it's what they call incremental budgeting. You'll start with a base. Our base in this case is, let's say, $1.6 billion on the operating side. And then we would add new initiatives. And in the past, what we would do is we would engage the board in a 3-, 4-, 5-month discussion about that increment. So we wouldn't be talking about the $1.6 billion. We'd be talking about that $30 million or $10 million or $20 million worth of new initiatives. And that's pretty much what we would talk about. So we're trying to change that discussion to talk about the whole budget and what you get for that entire $1.7 billion, not the increment anymore. So we're trying to move the discussion more to a strategic discussion and away from an incremental discussion. So a key to that is these what we call our business plans. So each department within Metro now has to develop a business plan. And that starts with the general manager. And the general manager's business plan sets the priorities and aligns itself with the strategic goals that the board has set. And in there, the general manager would say very specific things. He would set priorities such as, you know, so clearly safety is the top priority. He would set priorities like completing or, you know, getting the phase one of our fatigue management system up and running in this year. He would, in my case, my business plan, protecting our relationship with the federal government. The federal government is a very, very important funding partner for us, so I want to make sure they're getting clear information. We are making sure we use their dollars wisely, and we have a good relationship with the federal government. So that you kind of get the flavor for everybody around the department would have a business plan. In that business plan, they would describe measurements, goals, and actions to achieve the priorities of the general manager and also the strategic plan. Bus maintenance, for example, they've done a fabulous job. They've taken one of their key measures is mean distance between failures. So that's an actual failure when the bus has to come and for whatever reason is out of service. They have taken that number from about, I believe it's about 6,500 miles up to 8,000 miles in about 4 years. So dramatic improvement. But if you were to look in that business plan, there would be a whole host of activities for our shops and for the people that work in those shops. You know, the periodicity of the inspections, the types of inspections and so forth that have contributed to that increase in that type of a measure. So go to the next slide. So you can see as we go around the horn here, Up in the top left, these are business plan. These are just kind of some business plan actions from the general manager's plan. Implement the fatigue, starting in the top left there, fatigue risk management system. This is, you know, our employees. It's been proven that when employees don't get enough sleep, particularly our track workers, our frontline employees, it can be a dangerous situation. So we're taking that very seriously. We've partnered with a medical firm in Maryland, and they are helping us develop our fatigue management system. And that system will come up with recommendations such as, you know, changing shifts, changing employee behavior, reducing overtime, those things that contribute to employees working, you know, that working too many hours and then becoming fatigued and then making mistakes and then, you know, potentially either hurting themselves or our customers. So that's clearly at the top of the general manager's list. As we go down to the right, implementing the bus priority corridor network, 50% of our riders ride in these corridors. The last year, in 2013, we introduced about $3 million worth of new corridors. This year, in the general manager's budget, he's got another $5.5 million worth. So these would be corridors right now that our bus folks are out negotiating with the jurisdictions on exactly, you know, which routes, what's the frequency, that kind of thing. So that's still under development, but you'll see those probably more in the second half of the year. You'll see those rolling out. And then, of course, performing aggressive rehabilitation on our line segments. You've probably heard the general manager say on many occasions that we're trying to reverse that trend of underinvestment over all of these years. You know, it's not so dissimilar from your car.
My question is actually on the bus.
Sure.
Would 16th Street be considered one of the bus corridors or Georgia Avenue, or is that later in the presentation?
I've actually got a list. Let me double check for
16th Street. I was just trying to get in my mind if I'm understanding.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. So the rehab on the line segments, this is a very important part of our work. This is bringing the system up to a state of good repair and keeping it there. You all live with weekend closures. There's a lot of work being accomplished during those weekend closures on the lines. This is not very sexy stuff. It's the preservation, the maintenance of the facilities. It's kind of the meat and potatoes of what it is that we do, but it is very critical to what it is that we do. And it contributes to the reliability and the safety of the system and the longevity of the system. During those weekends, our rail crews were very proud of the work that they do. They've actually almost doubled the productivity by going to a much larger window. That window from Friday night all the way until Sunday morning. They're able to accomplish a lot more work. In the past, what we would do is we'd have narrower shutdowns. You've got about an hour to 2 hours on each end of each shutdown. So you can imagine if you've only got a six-hour window, 4 hours is, you know, 3 to 4 hours is gone on mobilization and cleanup. When you've got a 36 to, you know, 48-hour window or longer, then all of a sudden you've got much more productive time, and they're almost reaching shop rates. They're at about 80% productivity rate during those closures. So very, very positive activity. We're very proud of the work they do. Quality service of Metro Access, we've just awarded a new contract. They're operating side by side right now with the. You'll see more and more of the new contract as they roll it out over the course of the summer. Preparing for opening of the Silver Line Revenue Service, scheduled to open next year, probably early in January. I don't have the exact time, but right now our crews are busy testing, training, and so forth. And we've got 26 police officers in training right now. Additional police officers, a lot of track workers are being hired. And getting out on the lines and that kind of thing, and then actually testing the cars. So we're very excited about the Silver Line beginning revenue service later this fiscal year. Expanding capacity for 8-car trains. This we'll see a little bit later in the presentation. This is one of the seven key elements that the board has identified as an action item for what they're calling Metro 2025, the future vision of Metro. And we're actually, some of the work that we're doing right now, it's again, kind of back up in that rehabilitation kind of mode where we are actually preparing the system to accommodate 8-car trains. So it's the, I would call it the infrastructure that needs to be in place to operate the 8-car trains during rush hour. And then financial stability. replacing our oldest buses and rail cars. And again, this contributes back to the conversation I had earlier about the long lead mean time between failures for the buses. If you replace those vehicles at the appropriate time, it's much more efficient, and you're going to find you have a much longer life to your vehicles in the end. And then, of course, succession planning. Our people are our most important asset. Go ahead. So then we also measure all of these activities. So go ahead. So we have some key performance indicators. And as you come in on the right side, you probably see a large display. And these rates are up there. We had very good performance last year. I believe 11 of the indicators are actually positive as compared to last year. So we measure safety again, the key indicators of the injury rates for both employees and customers, and the crime rate at the stations. Go ahead. That's okay. And then, of course, on-time performance, bus rail access on-time performance. Again, excellent performance last year. I'll get into that in a moment. Escalator availability. I think over the last 3 years, you're starting to see the rewards now of some of the investments we started to make in that escalator and elevator program. As escalators become more reliable, as we replace our oldest escalators, our most troublesome escalators, I think that you're finding that out in the system, they're becoming much more reliable. And a new measure, we're going to try to come up with a customer satisfaction index. This is a, you know, in transit sometimes it's difficult. We often measure customer complaints, but that's really a backward-looking measure. You really need something to really start to get an idea of what it is the customers are feeling. And then that way you can really kind of tailor some of your investments to address their biggest concerns. Go ahead. Connecting communities, the dreaded TBD. We're working on those measures. We should have them hopefully this summer for sure. And financial stability. The operating expense on budget and capital funds invested. I'll get into it in a moment, but our capital program, our capacity to deliver capital projects has grown dramatically over the last 3 years. And our regional partners have really helped us turn around the condition of the system with the capital funding agreement that we have. And I'll get into that in a moment. But you can imagine that underneath all of these measures and in each of the business plans that I described, there are literally hundreds of actions and measures that align with these. So as you can see, they influence these measures. Each organization has safety measures. And you can imagine there's all kinds of activities that go on in both bus and rail for all of these activities that influence these measures. Go ahead. So this is actually from the 14 budget. So what's in the 14 budget in the three-year plan? What are the customers going to see? So remember in the past, I would probably be here talking to you saying, well, we've added $675,000 to improve station cooling. We've added $300,000 worth of for new Freon and added two employees. But we didn't really think that's what our customers want to know. They want to know. They don't want to know about the increment. They want to know about what is it that they're going to see this year. And so in the safety, I think, you know, we heard loud and clear from the community the station lighting was a huge issue. We're investing some $60 million, Tom, over the next 6 years on station lighting. Bumpy tiles will be installed in all stations. Our security camera network, I think we all are reminded how important that was a couple weeks ago in Boston. And we have got, we're actually our folks that are working on our security camera network. It's a great piece of work. And we feel very positive about our partnership with the Department of Homeland Security and the good work we're doing there to make the system safer. Customer safety communication campaign, I think you've probably seen that out lately. If you see something, say something, maybe some chapstick. If you go out on the weekends, they'll give you a little chapstick with a see something, say something on it, and there's all kinds of other good programs out there. And again, the fatigue risk management system. This is a very, very important initiative for us. Last year, we rolled it out in our power and our automatic train control groups. This year, the next groups are going to roll it out and will be our track and structures worker. These are the folks that work on the weekends. And then our rail and bus operators will be next. So as we start to develop this risk or fatigue risk management system, I think it's going to not only improve the safety, but also probably reduce overtime too. So that's a good thing. But clearly, the safety is at the heart of this initiative. The NTSB recommendations, we will close the 10 remaining recommendations. We've done a very good job on that. I'll just point out the employee wellness down at the bottom. It's a small initiative, but I know you've probably seen it, some larger companies around the country, private firms, they're actually engaging the employees in their own health and in their health care. And they either provide incentives or they provide programs where healthy behavior is rewarded. And it's been found to reduce costs. I worked at King County before I came here in Seattle, and the executive estimated over 3 years they saved $85 million for roughly about the same size employee base. But, you know, that covered all activities in the largest county in Washington State. So we're very excited about this employee wellness campaign. It's kicking off. It's a small thing. But we think it's a thing that over the next 5 to 10 years is going to have a big return on our health premium costs, which is one of our big drivers. Go ahead. And you can see the results on the right side. So, you know, you can see the theme here, quality service, the priority corridor network investments, the state of good operation investments. We're going to improve rail service reliability through the rehabilitation. You know, people don't often think of that rehabilitation activity that goes on. Sometimes it's a nuisance, but really they don't really think of it as it is really increasing the reliability, the on-time performance, and the safety of the system. It's so critical to what we do. Escalator of reliability, accelerate replacements. We talked about the paratransit contract, bus connections to rail stations. The board adopted new rail frequency standards earlier this year. We will meet those. And it's just a kind of a way that we need to change the way we view what it is we do, focus on the customer. And there is one of the first programs we're going to roll out is there's some training for our bus operators. These are small things, but I think, you know, I hope it demonstrates that we're focused on the customer.
Mr. Green.
Yes.
Mr. Green, let me just say for the record, I'm very happy that you are focusing on the customer in terms of training, particularly these bus operators, how to be more customer service oriented. And let me just say, as someone who rides buses fairly frequently, that training is definitely needed. Thank you.
I'm good. I'm glad to hear that. Go ahead. I also don't want to leave the impression it's just bus drivers. There's customer service training for all of our employees, and that is a focus of what it is that we do. Go ahead. Yeah, Mary Ann.
I don't know abbreviations yet.
Sure.
The PCN and SOGO.
Oh, I'm sorry. Priority Corridor Network. Those are those we talked earlier about those.
Yes.
And then the State of Good Operations.
Okay.
And that what the State of Good Operations is, you know, we're looking for ways to improve existing routes. You know, maybe changing the times, maybe adding a couple of trips. Maybe not as a big initiative as a Priority Corridor Network change, but you know, we can kind of tweak around the system and really help the rider. Prepare for an open silver line. We talked about that. The 8-car trains, we talked about it. So you're getting the theme here that we're connecting what it is that we do and what's in the budget to the strategic plan. We're using that framework to help us make those decisions. Go ahead. People and assets. And I think you're getting the idea here. So keep going. Okay, so the performance measures. So these are those indicators that we talked about, and off of my notes, I believe that last year we were up in about 8 of these. So that's actually quite impressive. Employee injury rate improved, customer injury rate improved, you know, all headed in the right direction. So clearly the investments that we're making and the priorities that we're setting are helping to influence us in the right direction. With those indicators, you know, they say if you don't keep score, you're just practicing. So we do keep score, we're having very positive results. So the employee injury rate, the customer injury rate, the crime rate, rail on-time performance, the capital investment rate, and the positions filled are all up. Very, very positive signs.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
Sure.
I'd like to know, the customer commendation rate, what is that? I mean, I know what commendation means. I mean,
how do you it's kind of cryptic,
that?
Isn't it? I believe it's 10.8 per 100,000. Per 100,000 passengers. I'll double check that for you. Is it a million or 100,000?
Yeah, I was actually looking at this today just before this meeting, and they measure one of the key indicators is how many customer commendations they get per, I think it's a million riders or something like that. And they measure that as one of the performance indicators. So that's what that refers to.
Okay, what about the complaint rate?
Complaint rate, same thing.
It's in the vital signs report on their website.
Right. So, you know, it's been my experience with these two measures, and we talked about this guy at the beginning, that it's not a very it definitely tells you kind of after the fact how you're performing. And you can use it as a tool to focus your initiatives on, you know, the common areas of complaints. Oh, is there, for this year or from what I'm comparing is the 12 to 13.
Q1 year to year.
Q1 from
2013 to 2012. Those are actually getting worse.
Q1 to Q. Okay, yeah, this, I'll have to check what this is, but I believe that this is, I think we're just looking at different time frames. Calendar year 13 targets. I'm sorry. Good point. My mistake. Thank you for the correction. What these are our targets for 13. Thank you. So what we're doing is we are increasing our targets for 13 to push the organization even more towards even better performance in those categories. Thank you.
So which are, I'm not clear, which of these do you guys think are leading indicators? Because they all look like following to me. But.
Yeah, they do, don't they? They are all following. Within the business plans, this is, I'd look at the, as they're titled, indicators. Within the business plans, there are literally hundreds of measures which have some forward-looking indicators. These are the kind of, you kind of get the, you kind of get the picture for the health of the organization, the overall health of the organization. If you were to go to BUS, you would get a, whole host of measures dealing with on-time performance, you know, by sector, by corridors. You would get, you know, clearly the commendation rates and particularly the complaint rates would be categorized by the types of complaints. So there's a lot more granularity than you're seeing on this page. These are kind of the high level. This is on my words, kind of the health of the organization type look, as opposed to the real detailed measures that are embedded in those business plans that the various departments in the organization use to drive performance.
So, you know, figuring out what good leading indicators is much harder than looking at following indicators.
Yep.
So, do systems exist, though, that you can actually figure out what the leading indicators are of some of these things? Or is this too early in your program to figure that out?
No, I would say, don't forget, what we're looking at here is we're looking at, as was pointed out, we're looking at our projection for calendar year 13, which is as compared to calendar year 12. Calendar 13 as compared to 12. So these are, in a way, we're setting these targets higher than the previous year. And so then if you can imagine now in the business plans what they're doing is there's a whole host of actions that they're undertaking to try to achieve those higher targets. Now, I know that's not exactly a leading indicator, but it is a strategy.
I get the idea. So you set a target, and people are supposed to hit the targets.
And not only are they supposed to hit it, but they're supposed to detail how they're going to hit it.
Right, but none of that is like what I'm asking. So I mean, it may be just be. It's. I'm not saying it's hard to do to figure out what they are. It's not trivially. It's easy to figure out what an injury rate is. It's hard to figure out what a leading indicator is for an injury rate.
Sure. I would say. You know, Andrea Burnside is our chief performance officer. That'd probably be an interesting discussion because she does those kinds of things, and I know within the business plans, and I know within our major departments they've got those types of measures. But I think it's more at the activity level almost. You know, bus on time performance. There's hundreds and hundreds of activities that influence that measure. And so you can imagine each of those activities then, or, you know, not each, but most of those activities then are measured. Now, how would you get a leading indicator? That'd be interesting.
But I guess my own experience is everything is made up of, like, everything you do, there's, like, lots of pieces. Mm-hmm. But almost always there's, like, one or two or three things that if you impact it, it moves the needle. And there's 50 things you could do all you want, and it doesn't make any difference.
Yep.
And so that's really, is really what I think, that's what I'm asking about. If the program is mature enough to actually figure out what those things are.
Well, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about it. And take bus, for example. So I think maybe I don't know if it's a leading indicator, and this is where, you know, this is kind of a academic discussion, but over on our capital program, for example, we've got a replacement plan for our buses. And so I would say I can tell you exactly how many buses we're going to replace over the next 10 years, year by year, a plan to replace those buses.
Sure.
And well, a plan to move that.
For buses, here's a leading indicator. Late preventive maintenance.
Yeah.
That's a leading indicator. That tells you that you'll have more breakdowns.
Right.
So, I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Right, and I think I'm saying the same thing with, yeah, with bus acquisitions. It's going to influence the same,
sure,
measure. And we've got, within the business plans, they've got that type of, and bus is a great example, they've got.
Yeah, bus is kind of easy.
Well, it's not only easy, but I would say, you know, that you've got one of the top bus systems in North America. I mean, but I mean, for on-time performance, yeah, I was a rider. I rode the D6. But as far as, you know, if you're to see the metrics that they publish and they live it, the, you know, the mean time between failures, on-time performance, those types of indicators. The maintenance group has done just an outstanding job, and so I think they're getting at some of those things you're talking about. I agree with you. It'd be interesting to see some of the others. Okay. So let's talk about the 14 budget. Total of 2.7, okay. Broken into these pieces. So we've got an operating budget of about $1.7 billion. A capital budget of about almost $1 billion, and then a reimbursable budget. We'll talk about these three pieces as we go. Go ahead. So the operating budget is broken down into three major pieces. The base, which we talked about. This is the discussion we had about incremental budgeting. The increases to the base. This would be inflationary increases, maybe the cost of fuel is going up, those base costs that are kind of go with the business. And then the new initiative, $16.7 million. So you can see this year we added about $17 million worth of new initiatives, and that would be, you know, we talked a little bit about the fatigue management. We talked a little bit about the priority corridor networks, those kinds of things, state of good operations. Those types of things are kind of the big pieces. Customer demand over in the capital budget, kind of two pieces. And the way customer demand and state of good repair, customer demand I would kind of portray as kind of those capacity type projects. Improvement projects is another terminology you probably heard in other places. These are not those preservation, state of good repair type projects. So you can see over 90% of our capital budget is invested in trying to bring the system up to the state of good repair. And you'll see that pattern repeating out over the six-year plan as well. And then the reimbursable budgets, these are activities we do for others. We may be buying some buses, operating some service, maybe constructing a project for another jurisdiction, that kind of thing. So this is kind of a reimbursable type activity. Go ahead. And then the board was interested also, I think in past years, we would focus on a year-by-year budget perspective. And it really did a disservice to the board. I think that it kind of boxed them in a little bit. They really couldn't see the impact of some of their decisions in the out years. So what we've tried to do now is give them more of a six-year look. So the blue you can see is the operating, and the green is the capital. And we'll get into some of the I'll get a little deeper into this discussion. But on the top part of that chart is the expense side, and on the bottom side is the jurisdictional subsidies. Sure. Sure. Well, we'll get into that, but we've got a capital funding agreement right now through FY16. So those are dollars that we have an agreement with our jurisdictional partners for a $5 billion capital improvement program. And then what we did is we just projected that out over the next 3 years. Go ahead. So the operating budget, it's funded through revenues from passenger fares, parking, advertising, and some miscellaneous kind of business revenues, fiber optic leases. Covers about 55%. I think it's not quite 55.5. It's about 55 next year. And then the remaining balance is subsidized by our local partners. And there's a whole series of allocation formulas, and I included them in there so you can see how those formulas are calculated. go ahead. And this is the budget detail. This is kind of the more traditional look at our budget. So a lot of numbers, but I'll just break it down quickly for you. So you can see the top, the total revenue line. We're looking at about revenues that we generate from passenger and parking fares in 14 is about $845 million. Other revenues, this would be advertising, maybe some property sales, maybe some fiber optic revenues, that kind of thing, about another $47 million. Total revenues coming into the system, and this is the operating program only, $892 million. And then you can see there are big expense categories. About 70% of our operating cost is labor. And when I say labor, I mean payroll, pension, health benefits, that kind of thing. So you can see how that breaks down. Sure.
I'm looking at your pension. Let me just ask you this, and I know you're not HR, but pension, of course, has to do with past employees who've been around and who, when they retire, they get their pension. Mm-hmm. But when you have newer employees, are they incorporated into the pension or under 401k? And like I said, I understand you're not HR, but right.
The represented employees are still in the programs that are set up, the kind of traditional defined contribution programs. Non-represented employees like myself are more in a defined benefit, like the 401k. I think it's not a 401k, it's a different name, but it's a similar idea. I contribute so much, and it goes into a savings account. The employer matches up to a certain percentage. Whereas on the other programs for some of our employees, particularly you know, our operators, our rail track workers, or unionized employees, they get more of a benefit, a defined benefit for each year of service. So I know where I came from, I got 2% for each year of service, something along those lines. So does that answer your question? Okay. And then you can see, okay, so then, again, this is a look at the operating program, again, over 6 years. So what's important here to see is that we had a challenge this year as we went from 13, if you look from 13 to 15, we really just had to bridge ourselves to get to 15. So what we did was we undertook a lot of reductions, a lot of savings initiatives. We had the good fortune to have an underrun from last year, or excuse me, a budget surplus, that we were able to apply about $30 million to reduce the jurisdictional contribution. So at the end of the day, year over year, the jurisdictional contribution went up about $27 million to fund our operating program. I think that was very helpful to the jurisdictional partners to get us to 2015. So we kind of bridged that gap, because you can see then from 14 to 15, I don't believe the increase is quite so steep. And you can see we went up 27, and now we're getting back down to about 26. So we're able to kind of flatten that growth. Initially, we had about $100 million gap, but through the, you know, and again, it was not all. There was certainly some management actions in there. There was a use of some reserves and so forth. Not reserves, excuse me, surpluses. We were able to get that number down to about $27 million. Go ahead. So here's the allocation discussion, and I'm going to let you go through this, but let me just tell you that our rail. The way we calculate our rail subsidy, you can see it's based on three different factors: density, weekday ridership, number of rail stations, and then there's a calculation for the max fare subsidy. And I'd be happy to come back and go through this in detail with you sometime. But I think it's just to give you an idea of how we determine that allocation by jurisdiction. Go ahead. Again, with the bus, there's two pieces. There's the regional bus subsidy and the non-regional bus subsidy. You can see we've got the factors. We negotiate these with our jurisdictional partners. We go through this very carefully with them, and this is how we determine what each jurisdiction share is, which I'll show you in a moment. Go ahead.
What's platform?
Sure. Back
what's
up.
Platform hours as it relates to buses?
I beg your pardon?
Platform hours.
What is a platform hour?
Yeah.
That's an hour that it's out in service in the field. Go ahead. Regional routes, again, this is part of the calculation. Go ahead. And then the subsidy allocation. So again, you can read through this. It's a whole other discussion, but I'd be happy, if you're interested, I'd be happy to bring our experts in here. We can go through this detail by detail with you. Go ahead. So what does that all mean? So for the current year that we're in, FY13, which ends on June 30th, this kind of gives you a feel for by mode how the budget works. So you can see there, bus, we've got passenger fares about $141 million, other revenue about $13 million, and you can see at the bottom line, we believe our cost recovery is about 27%, which is about typical, or, you know, nationally it's about in that range, 20 to 30%. I'd say we're maybe in the upper third, maybe. What's really impressive, though, if you look at the rail, 79% cost recovery. That means that we're recovering 79% of the gross operating costs from fares and other revenues.
Obviously, the outlier there is Metro Access, which you only get 7% of your cost recovery there. How is that in line with other transit systems? Is that pretty typical, average?
Yeah, it's pretty typical. I'll show you on the next chart here. It's a very expensive service to provide, a very important service, but a very expensive service. And here's another chart that gets at your point. So you can see here what it costs per rider. And again, this was an FY13 number, and this was back. We did this in the fall. So again, you know, these numbers may not be exactly jive with where we are today, but they're in the ballpark. They give you an idea. So you can see rail and bus cost per rider is about this, you know, relatively close, within 10% or so. And then access is very expensive. Well, you can imagine, though, you know, it's a dedicated vehicle. You have to get that rider. A lot of people don't know this, but our access department is an award-winning department. They've won national awards for their innovative methodologies. And as far as controlling costs, they've done a very smart thing. What they did is they now offer people that are, I'm not going to use the right word, not certified, but they have to come in through a process to receive the access benefit.
Qualify, thank you.
What we've done is for those passengers that you know are ambulatory, that can make it onto the bus, that can make it onto the rail, they get a free pass. So you can see at $435 a rider. That's a lot of trips every year. But it's not only is it a bargain, but it helps the system as a whole, and it helps those people. And so I really think it's a great idea, and it really helps. Helps with our costs, certainly. I'm sure those people are very pleased by the service, and I think it's a very innovative idea, and I think Christian Cantu, our director of that service, deserves a lot of credit for really, really coming up with a world-class access system that we have. I know the numbers look high, but we're doing everything we can to control them. And at one point, they were going up so fast until Christian actually brought some of these techniques in. Yeah. I don't know what you mean by that, but I rationalize.
I can tell you what it means.
Sure, go ahead.
It means that the parking lots are always full.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you that if they're especially full at the time, you'd like to have empty spaces, because during the rush hour, you want people to be able to park so they can pay the high fee. And instead, they're always full. So
they can't park. Well, demand management, I mean, I think we just went through a round of public involvement last year, and that was certainly one of the topics was the parking fees, and we did raise them. Yeah, they do. And I think there were some very compelling arguments made. I think we only bumped them 25 cents, as I recall. But what are they now? They're in the range of 350, 4.25, somewhere in that range, depending on the station. And we do have a program where you can – I'm getting a bit out of my element here. 450. You know, but it's in that range. And I'm a little out of my element, but I know we have a program that you can actually reserve. You can participate. You pay a premium, but you can have a reserve space. Parking is a huge revenue source for us. You know, it could be bigger if we had more space, if we charge more, you know, I don't know how that elasticity works on parking. I'm sure it works.
Does that count as passenger revenue?
Yes, it does. On the rail side. It's all in rail. because it supports the rail facilities. You know, it's a, I hear what you're saying. It's a, we'll certainly be revisiting that again. In FY15, we're going through another round of fare changes, so I'm sure that's going to come up again. You know, what's the right number? I don't know.
Incentivize people. And so one thing you would think Metro would want to do is make people ride the bus more to the metro station. And there, as they keep the bus fares down, raise the ticket balance up to the parking to get more people on the bus.
If I'm not mistaken, I think we're going to see that play out, how that's really going to play out when the Silver Line opens, because already they're sort of backing off their no parking at the Silver Line. I mean, what my understanding is that, I just sort of skimmed through the article, but my understanding is that Metro is out looking for developers, looking for temporary parking, transition parking, and we'll just sort of see how that plays out, because I think that people who drive cars are a powerful lobby. And yeah. I think that it's a, I agree with you, the economics don't, you know, say we should raise parking, but I think the politics say that the people who want to park their vehicles for a relatively modest rate outweigh those who see the logic of not doing that. That's my opinion.
If any of you get an opportunity tomorrow, or maybe you can check online, there's going to be a presentation tomorrow at the Finance and Administration Committee. A young guy works for me. His name's Mark Schofield. He gave a presentation, I believe, 2 months ago on rail ridership, and he really does an interesting job of taking the data and breaking it down and looking at the trends, and it's difficult. It's a difficult analysis to do, but now he's done bus, and he's what you're describing is one of the theories that there are a lot more people riding bus, or, you know, it's difficult to project how many people have actually moved from rail to bus, but he's going to talk about that tomorrow, and there has been some migration in that direction. But if you get an opportunity, either if you go online to the website, I think probably,
I can send it around.
Yeah, send it around. I don't know how soon it's posted after he gives the presentation.
We'll post it on Monday.
But actually him giving the presentation. Will there be video of the presentation or just
audio?
Or just audio? Yep. It's pretty interesting. And the slides are kind of dynamic, so I don't know, that might get lost a little bit in the translation of a packet, a PDF. But it's interesting stuff. And that's the kind of information that we're going to use more and more as we get into the next round of discussions about fares and ridership, and as you said, you know, behavior, passenger behavior, that kind of thing, you know, as far as it pertains to trip choices. So this is an interesting chart. Go ahead. Okay, so then this is the bottom line for our jurisdictional partners. What they really want to know is, what's my share? So you can see we're comparing FY13 to FY14 here, and this is that $27 million increase I talked about.
So this is not really a million, it's really a thousand.
Yep.
That would be
a lot of money. That would be a lot of money.
You just quit
now and you're done. Yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't have to worry. So thanks. Good catch. As I said, I put this together kind of quick.
Do you have a sense of what percentage of these jurisdictional budgets are dedicated to this line item, and whether it varies a lot between the jurisdictions?
I don't know that, but I would imagine that it does. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, as you go from year to year, particularly in a year like this year where we're introducing a new service, the Silver Line. It's some $50 million in expenses this year. It's interesting with how it impacts the jurisdictions differently. So,
and when does Loudoun County come into that equation budgetarily?
2019, it's out there.
So only when phase two is open?
Yeah, when phase two is open.
Okay. We're complete, not even under construction doesn't count?
Under revenue service, I believe.
Okay.
To be determined, yeah. That's still part of the negotiations.
Fair enough.
Because, that they need to negotiate that. That's certainly up to them. So, interesting. Here's the capital. And we'll get to the capital in a minute. A little bit different calculation here, and we'll talk about that. Again, the capital, the allocation is based on the operating formulas. And you'll see as you go back into the text, that's how it's derived. Go ahead. So the capital budget. This is our capital program where we rebuild the system, we buy new rail cars, new buses, we rehabilitate buses and rail cars, and we make station improvements, that kind of thing. So you can see we start with what we call our capital needs inventory. This identifies the needs in the system. We did about a 10-year capital plan 2 years, 3 years ago. It was estimated about $11 billion in needs over a 10-year period. We updated it last year. That same project list with a few additions went to about $13 million. And then the investment categories, again, the same ones you've seen before, performance, which is kind of that state of good repair, and your customer demand or expansion capacity, however you like it. And again, we link it to our agency goals, and we generate a call from our capital project manager. So a couple important points this year. Go ahead, next slide, please. We're going to be incorporating in, we're updating our CNI right now. We're starting that process. We'll be identifying new needs, and now we'll be rolling in the work that the board's been doing, starting to price out the work they've been doing on Metro 2025. So as our plan now goes out to 2025 on the CNI, this kind of needs, all the needs that are out there, you're going to start to see those projects that the board's identified in 2025, and you're going to see what those costs, and you're going to see, you know, that CNI is going to go up dramatically. And the incorporation of asset management, the Federal Transit Administration, and their new rules, and they're very important funding partners. You'll see in a second. They are requiring all the transit agencies to become much better in the way they manage and report on their assets. A lot of new requirements, and we're wrestling with that like a lot of our transit agencies are. But I think we've got a head start on that, and so we're in pretty good shape. Go ahead. So the capital funding agreement, I talked about this briefly. It was signed in June 2010. It was a six-year plan put in place, $5 billion. It included federal funding. It acknowledged that there was $1.5 billion in what we call PREA funds. It's kind of dedicated passenger rail infrastructure improvement account funds. And then the jurisdictions, the three major jurisdictions, match that on a 50-50 basis. So that's a huge part of our funding. That's over 10 years. Expenditure-based program, this is kind of a technical issue, but in the past, some of the programs, I don't know how many of you are familiar, they were kind of encumbrance-based or expenditure-based. So, you know, when do you really need the money? When are you really going to spend it? And then there's requirements that we report to the project expenditures and so forth. Go ahead. So this is kind of your traditional sources and uses for the current. So what the board adopted in April, they adopted a capital budget for the appropriation year, which is FY14. And then because the capital program isn't really a one-year program, you really have to look at capital. It's a six-year plan. You're always in the process of designing projects. Projects are in various states of completion and so forth. And you really need to get ahead of some of these projects. So they also adopted a plan, a six-year plan of a $5.23 billion. You can see, this is where I talked about, 92% of that on the pie on the left, the real bright line, is state of good repair. So 92% of that $5 billion investment is on preserving the rail system, repairing buses, purchasing new buses to replace old buses. It's that kind of meat and potatoes, as I would call it. You know, it's the repair of the system and the preservation of the infrastructure. And then the customer demand, $400 million. Maybe there's some planning activity in there for a couple of expansion jobs maybe out in the future. And we'll get to some of the things that are in Metro 2025. They're also contained in there in a second. So over on the right side, how do you pay for that? This kind of this classic sources and uses. The biggest contributor comes from the federal government, $2.5 billion. That's a lot of money. And as I told you in my business plan, that's my job to make sure that we do a good job of managing that money, reporting on it, and then taking care of that relationship. And it's a great relationship we have with the feds. And then the state local. That's the money that you use to match the grants. Typically, the grants that we get are 80-20. You'll get a grant that's 80% federal. You have to match with 20% local funds. And on our PREA, as I said before, it's a 50-50 situation. And those are 50% federal, 50% matched by our local jurisdictions. And then we've got some bonds, authorization to sell bonds, to buy the new 7,000 series rail cars. Sure. No, the D.C. jurisdictions and state and local. Could you flip back a couple slides, please?
It's okay.
I'll show you in just a sec. I'll show you on this page if you go back right there. Right there. This kind of breaks down the jurisdictional contribution. So if you looked at the District of Columbia there at the very top, just to give you a feel for the magnitude, in 14 they're going to contribute $130 million of about a roughly billion-dollar program. Thank you. Sure. Okay, so what this slide shows us is, remember we talked about the capital needs inventory. This is kind of our total needs. And you can see that we're projecting, and this was based on the capital funding agreement we have with our partners. We projected about $11 million that is now projecting at about $13 billion worth of needs. That's the complete bar. And we project through 19, we're going to have made $5.5 billion worth of investments, $7 billion total, $5.5 over the next 6 years. And then you can see the other pieces that we made in 11 and 12 and in 13. So we've spent about $7.2 million in state of good repair. That leaves us with an unfunded need of about $5 billion. If we continue, this is back to your question earlier about the revenue stream. If we project a constant source stream of funding, we would still be about $5 million short of that needs inventory that we've identified. And the pie over on the right kind of breaks down that need. And you can see that the heavy investment in state of good repair that we're funding has led that the unfunded need is primarily in that customer demand, which makes sense. Our top priorities are safety, preservation, state of good repair, security. Okay. So the capital improvement program for FY 11 to 19, go ahead. Okay, so this shows you that six-year plan. And what's interesting about this, you can see that in 11, these 11 and 12 are actuals. This is how much we actually spent. So I talked earlier about our capacity to deliver capital projects. You can see in FY 11, we delivered about $611 million worth of capital projects, which was a very large program for us. Last year, we delivered about 745. This year, we're projecting almost 900, about 880, something like that. So you can see we're building that capacity to deliver these capital programs. And we're going to peak at about in 2016. And you can see what the colored bars are there. You can see that the federal is the bottom bar, and that remains relatively constant. And then you can see that the state and local remains relatively constant. So if you just focus your eyes at the top of that first two bars, the blue and the white bar, you can see that our funding actually remains constant. Where we really get that bump up in the purple, that is the bonds. And that what that is those are the rail cars. So you'll see the 7,000 series rail cars. So really that's that peak in our program.
And there's no way to sort of spread out that debt at all? I mean,
well, that's not the debt. That's the actual issuance. The debt service then is over in the operating program.
Ah, I see what you're saying.
And that's a steady stream going out.
Fair enough.
Go ahead. Okay, so this dotted line that you see appears, that is, back to your question, that's the end of our capital funding agreement. So we are, in effect, funded through that period. We have an agreement with our partners. They're committed to making that $5 billion investment over that period, and that's about where we'll end up. Go ahead. Now, you've heard a lot about Metro 2025. We would project that's this new bar of funding. So this is a new revenue source we're going to have to work with our partners to come up with a way to fund those initiatives that we need to meet the priorities and needs of Metro 2025. Go ahead. So Metro 2025, what's in there? These are, I told you earlier about the seven priorities. I hope there's seven here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yay. Okay, so the eight-car trains. This is a project. These are very preliminary estimates. These are rough order magnitude estimates. We presented this to the board in April. And this is what I talked to you about. So eight-car trains, what this would be eight-car trains, 100% eight-car trains during rush hour. And we're making those investments right now in the infrastructure necessary to support that need. So you can see there, we're getting some expansion rail cars, engineering, design of maintenance and storage facility, and power upgrades. Those are the activities we're doing right now that's funded out to 2019, or in our six-year horizon. Core station improvements, you can see them, Union Station, Gallery Place access and capacity improvements. You can see there's a much bigger need identified in our strategic plan. But these are just the investments on that first column that are occurring in this six-year period. Okay, go ahead, next slide. So this is really the focus of our six-year plan. Remember that 92%? These are the kinds of activities we're going to be doing. And if you ever go out there on a weekend closure, it's quite impressive. They've got all the different crafts are out there. The maintenance folks are out there. They just blitz these areas. They are working on the track. They're rehabilitating the stations. They're working on the bumpy tiles. They're putting in lighting. The guys are in there with the security cameras. It's just like a beehive. It's very impressive the amount of work they get accomplished in a weekend. That gets back to the production rights that I was talking about. So you can see all the types of state of good operations, state of good repair type activities that we're really focused on to get the system up to that level and to prepare for that next step into the future.
I have a question.
Sure.
I think I was told this one time. My understanding is that the money that's spent on shuttles and buses and drivers during this, mm-hmm. this comes out of the capital budget,
that's right?
Not the operating budget.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's a good point. So as the capital budget impacts operations, those costs to carry the passengers to make that bridge are charged to the project for that weekend, and they're considered part of the project costs. Go ahead. So this kind of gives you the feel for how our budget process works. I know I've kind of overwhelmed you, but I was trying to cover as many of the bases as I could. We have an annual budget call. This is the kind of the capital process, and I won't go through it all, but basically you can see how it works. It's a very rigorous prioritization process where we go through, we look for a return on value, that kind of thing, and there's a ranking and a priority right now, heavily, as you can see, 92% focused on safety and state of good repair. But reimbursable projects, we just talked briefly. I promise we're almost done. These are the projects that are requested by jurisdictions. The jurisdiction typically funds them and they're operating and capital projects, and they are outside of the annual budget. And there's a mechanism for us to go during the year if one of our jurisdictional partners comes to us and says, you know, can you maybe help us design this project or build that project? We step in and do that, and we go to the board and get an expenditure authority that is then funded by our jurisdictional partners.
So
yeah?
So, in other words, the approval process has to do with expenditure authority, not.
Right. And we get the expenditure. Exactly. And then the revenue comes in from the jurisdiction, but we have to have that authority to expend.
Would that
include the No. That's a capital project.
Thanks very much for coming. This has been.
Sure. We've got the streetcar, DC streetcar project. Let's see. Silver Line. Silver Line's a jurisdiction. That's probably the best one. Silver Line. I'm thinking on the operating side. They're typically more on the capital. This year it's kind of an oddity. When I showed it was at number 135, it's almost split perfectly equal between operating and capital this year, which is very odd. But it just broke that way this year. Yes, yeah, and what will happen with those is they will actually work their way into the operating budget eventually. So, there was a slide that showed on the bus allocation, there was the regional buses and then the non-regional. That's a good example. That Alexandria, the operating cost would actually get added, and it did get added to our operating budget right at the end. It was about $1 million or something, or several million dollars. It got added right at the end of the budget process. It would. The purchase of the buses was a reimbursable. But at the end of the day, it's kind of different, but there's two mechanisms. So the purchase of the buses was on the reimbursable capital project. But then now as we operate the buses, it goes in the operating budget. But through the formula, through that formula, those jurisdictions actually pay for that service. So it's all rolled into the bus operating costs, but that particular piece of service is actually paid for by Arlington and Alexandria. Is that answer your question?
One comment, two questions.
Sure.
Comment first. Now that we know just enough to be dangerous, I want to reiterate that we're here to be used in a way as a tool by Metro.
Sure.
For, you know, we represent various jurisdictions, mm-hmm. and we would like to advocate for Metro's bottom line within those jurisdictions. And
absolutely.
Unfortunately, Metro has really not used us as proxies as much as we probably should. So I just want to encourage you as we go forward to use us in that sense, you know, get us to go testify, to write letters, to do all of that. What?
Virginia could pay more.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us have particularly said that, you know, jurisdictions should up their contribution as necessary. So, anyway.
Well, no, I appreciate the value that committees like yours serve. As I said, my background is very much our program was influenced by the input from committees like yours. Right.
I believe that was just tweeted across the region. Anyway.
Well, and I've also seen on the our accessibility committee, the outstanding job of advocating for their constituents. And the lighting program is a great example. You know, they've worked with us closely, and that's made its way into the priorities. And that's the way you can influence the process, is be part of the process.
Yeah. One of the things that we've been looking at is, in terms of advocating for riders, is when the Silver Line comes on, obviously, blue line riders, for certain areas at least, are going to be experiencing a decrease in service. And I just sort of like a data call. If we as the RAC were to advocate for a cut in the fare for blue line riders who are affected by the outcome of the Silver Line, so I'm talking specifically riders who get on from Franconia Springfield to Arlington Cemetery, mm-hmm. and then leave the system at Farragut West to Vienna, what would the impact of that be on Metro's bottom line?
Here's what I would tell you. Every year during our fare process, there's opportunities for public input, lots of opportunities. And I don't know if you'll recall in the spring of 2012, there was a huge influence made through that public process. So I would encourage all of you to fully participate in that process. There'll be public hearings out in your communities, every community, and there'll be opportunities online and other opportunities that we have to make your voice heard,
sure.
and to advocate for those positions.
But in order to really make our voice heard effectively on this,
sure.
we need some information from Metro in terms of how this would impact the budget, and is it something that's actually realistic for us to advocate for? So if it's possible to get that number, and I'm assuming that you can project that or use existing data in some way, you know, that's something that I'd be interested in.
Yeah, I think
in knowing.
You know, I think you know, like I said, send your emails through our customer service group, and we'll see what we can get.
Okay. And the other question I have is, one thing that I think we've struggled to get a handle on is the relationship between fare adjustments, increases or decreases, and ridership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for every cent that fares go up, how many riders exit the system permanently,
right.
or find other modes of transportation. And do you have a sense of that in terms of how the budget has worked in the past?
You know,
it's a complicated
it's
question.
It's very complex, and there's so many factors play into it. You know, you're changing fare structures in the face of economic conditions that are changing. You had this threat of sequestration. You had the threat of the government shutdown. You had, as I mentioned, you had the federal transit benefit swinging so wildly. You had, fuel prices spiking in February. So you've got all these factors playing. I think if you look, go to the presentation that we gave on rail ridership, because we talk about that a little bit, the elasticity.
Mm.
But there's so many factors in play that sometimes it's difficult to talk about what was the specific impact of that fare increase, because not only is it difficult with all the other factors in play, but it varies by population, it varies by route, it varies by the type of riders we have. Some are less sensitive to the fare increase than others, and I'm sure that all of you felt this. Depending on the time of day, the day of the week, your fares were impacted in a different manner.
Yeah. Area where when we try to advocate for rider positions, we really need some help from Metro in terms of the data. You know, if we say, hey, if you raise fares, people are going to bolt from the system, but we don't have any data to back that up, and maybe it's not even true, you know, it makes it difficult for us to really drive it home.
Have a look at that. I believe it was the March presentation.
Just to the
February
board.
Or March, yeah.
Okay.
Go online, and there was it's just called Rail Ridership, and I think in there he actually does make an estimate for this last fare. he tries to separate out all the factors and make a call of what that impact was of the elasticity. And I know it's different for both bus and for rail.
Right. Thank you.
Sure. And again, if there's any of these topics, I kind of threw a lot out here. And again, thanks for catching. I know I have a lot of errors in here. I appreciate your patience. If there's any particular topics that you'd like to get more information on, I'd be happy to come back and speak with you again.
Mr. Green, sure. Folks online are following along. Can this get posted? It's actually a really good presentation.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to clean it up a little bit.
Sure.
Sure. We'll have to check. But
yeah, just when you can get it to me.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I kind of took pieces of presentations. It was more to give you not so much a data point to measure from, but more to give you a feel for the process.
Mostly they've asked how the formula is, that why is this jurisdiction paid more than the other, and that's
sure.
Not too much to explain.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you what.
Really here.
Oh, you know, sure, there's that. And then also I think even better than that is in our budget books, there is documentation with even more information about the formulas, and I can give you links to those, and they're very comprehensive. Why don't we start with that and see if that meets your needs, and then we'll provide you those links. They're very good. The budget books, award-winning budget books, published by my organization. Sure.
I have a question back about including the data to JR, the budget to support the operating cost. I want to know if we can meet our own county or council representative and go away and give a testimony why they should be able to give more money with that information that this guy has given us. I'm just suggesting.
Yeah, there's lots of ways that you can advocate. I mean, you know, clearly you can talk with other people and join your voices. There's lots of ways. But again, I'd like to reiterate that we have a very comprehensive public involvement process. So, you know, I'd encourage you to participate in that.
Ben, just to respond to your point before about the blue line, the Office of Planning released an origin destination data set from a while back. So if it's diplomatic, it's not me, could use staff time to run that for you. Somebody could easily put together a custom tabulation of ridership between those origin points and those destination points, and to get fair about that, and then press that you've got a revenue figure. So there are resources around to leverage to get that.
Thank you. That concludes the Budget and Finance Committee. Thank you for attending, and we'll look for you next month, second Wednesday, different topic, different speaker, and different time, and a 5-minute break.